The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams. We know that there is more than one possible future. Now we have adjusted to what has been called the new normal. We are asked again to further adapt to a new normal. Today I'm joined by Peter Black for a practical talk to discuss deep driver of change. Peter is director of Essential Foresight and has extensive expertise in foresight and emerging infectious diseases. Previously, Peter was a veterinary epidemiologist and worked on emerging infectious diseases for 25 years. Welcome, Peter, and thank you to be here with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you in these very strange times.
Absolutely, yeah, very strange time. So early on, you and Sohail, who was a guest to the show previously, have developed four different scenarios for COVID-19. So today we are revisiting three of those with a lens of we as a global citizens are serious about real prevention strategies. So before we deep dive into the three possible scenarios you developed, shall we explain to the listener the reason why of this lens?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when we actually wrote that blog for the Journal of Future Studies in March this year, we had a number of scenarios, but we finished by drawing some conclusions about the next steps. And some of the next steps were the sort of more mundane and pragmatic things like looking at whether there should be controls over the wildlife trade and wet markets that have wildlife trade. And we also looked at things like improving the capacity to detect disease even earlier with a whole range of technologies. But the final thing that we talked about was that critically there would need to be increased investment in what we call real prevention strategies. And they're the sorts of strategies that acknowledge that the majority of zoonotic pathogens like COVID-19, the virus that causes COVID-19, are actually emerging because of the changes in food production, agriculture, land use, and the contact with wildlife. But the fundamental issue, which we actually said at the very end, was the real prevention strategy means we have to rethink this issue about more development model, that this fundamental issue of growth and wanting more economic growth is a big part of the problem, and that we have to address that issue head on. So I have chosen to go back and look at those scenarios through the lens of what it means to actually rethink that more development model and what it might mean in association with a number of scenarios which we outlined earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more and more has always been discussed as a, you know, a society we are building technology, it's improving, it's going forward, but sometimes it's not always for the better, but it's just taking something out from the nature, from our society, and in bringing these into the negative aspect of the society, that is, you know, COVID-19 could be a consequences of us living in our planet.
Yeah, a number of emerging infectious diseases over the last 20 or 30 years are really indirectly associated with the fact that we are changing the planet in such fundamental ways. And the reason that we're changing the planet is not just driven by the fact that there are more people, well, that's a very important part of the puzzle. It's also that we want to actually consume more. And so the planet generally, if you compare it to, you know, 1950 compared to now, there was a lot more biodiversity and native forests, etc., on the planet than there are now. We are actually in the sixth, mass extinction phase right now because of what we're doing on the planet. Mm-hmm. And part of the consequences of those changes are linked to emerging infectious disease. But not only that, there's some other issues as well, which I think we'll cover when we talk about the scenarios, but there are some relationships there.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess you already touched a little bit on deep drivers. What are those and how to spot them? You know, I mean, do you need to be an expert on infectious diseases as you are?
You don't need to be an expert to understand that the planet is changing. From an emerging infectious disease perspective, perhaps you need to understand what some of the drivers are which lead and promote the emergence of some of these pathogens. But from a very basic level, if you look at what we've done to the planet, we are increasing our contact with animals and the associated pathogens that they carry because we are compressing them into more and more tight spaces, in a sense, and we are invading their habitat. And that's because we are using more and more of the planet in a whole range of ways. It's not just that we are, as a growing population, expanding where we live, but also the way that we consume resources and we build new roads and we have new mines and extractive industries also change the interface with where these pathogens are. So I don't think, I mean, being an expert and having an interest in this, I suppose I've been thinking about this for a very long time, but I don't think it's beyond most people's comprehension to understand that what we are doing in the current stage of so-called development is increasing the contact with wildlife, animals, and the pathogens they have. Now, it's not to say that we actually haven't had diseases which come from animals for a long time. This is not a new event. In fact, a number of the diseases, if you look at the pathogens which have caused the big pandemics over a long period of time, most of them are in fact zoonoses. So, you know, if you look back at plague, it's a bacillus which comes from rats. Or if you look more recently, the big one which people are probably familiar with is HIV/AIDS. You know, this is a virus which has come out of chimpanzees in Africa as a result, very likely, of bush hunting for meat. So, and that led to quite a big pandemic globally. So it's not like this is a totally new event. And even our exposure to domestic animals, you know, thousands of years ago did actually introduce diseases to us, like smallpox, you know, was related to the pox virus. It's a pox virus which has come from animals. Or measles is actually a virus which is very likely transferred from cattle thousands of years ago. It's in the same class as rinderpest. So these things have been happening on a number of occasions. It's not a new event. It's just that we are accelerating. We are seeing more of this happening more often as we have put more pressure on the planet.
That's pretty clear. So let's jump into the three scenarios, shall we?
Sure. So the first scenario that I'm going to talk about is actually the one which we called the needed pause, which was really to do with, and I would say that this is the equivalent of a new equilibrium scenario. And that scenario talked about the fact that most countries would actually put efforts in to flatten the curve and that they'd help their health systems cope and that there would be a decreased rate of sickness and death. And I think at least in the first wave, we have seen that that's occurred. However, in that scenario, we thought that over time, COVID-19 would become more like another winter flu. It would be dangerous for the elderly and for people with underlying medical conditions and people who smoke, etc. But actually, we were thinking that in March this year that it could actually become routinized by perhaps early 21 if a vaccine was available. Now, we know that that's not likely to be the case in the time period which you had in that scenario, but it could be the case by perhaps the end of next year. that scenario also talked about the fact that what happens is that the frenetic pace of everything slows down, which we have seen, with actually a number of benefits for the planet and even for personal health. So we know that greenhouse gas emissions have fallen, for starters, and that's as a result of the fact that there's a lot less movement and activity and air travel and generally, so that's happened. And even we mentioned that in over-touristed cities actually get a break, and that's also happened. In fact, this scenario talks about localization sort of healing people. People start to work from home, and we've seen that as a big part of what's happened in the last since the early part of this year. And there's, however, a variability about how desirable that working from home is seen, and that's related to trust as a factor from employers. But after the pause, this scenario claims that we would probably return to a new business as usual. Not exactly what we had before, but we actually slowed down in order to speed up again. So it was a pause more than a major change. And so when I looked at this scenario through this lens of economic growth, I thought that really what has been happening and what's happening now, in my experience, is that governments are actually looking at the cost of the pandemic to the economy, and they're putting in pressures, a lot of measures to support and grow the economy in the longer term. At the moment, they're just trying to keep people in work or keep things functioning, but over time, most of them are talking about economic growth, which will actually help to come out the other side of the pandemic. So in this scenario, there's actually no discussion of whether economic growth actually may have contributed in any way to the emergence of the virus. So the deep drivers I'm saying in this scenario are actually conveniently either consciously or subconsciously ignored. And of course, election cycles don't encourage longer term thinking, and governments are looking to the familiar options to recover as quickly as they can. So that's the needed pause scenario with a lens of looking at what the economic growth issue as a driver, which doesn't really get much attention in this scenario.
Yeah, we saw major companies like Google saying to their employees that they can work from home until July 2021. So that was like early on COVID. So that was, you know, a foresight of 1 year of working from home. And there are many other people that it said it takes 6 months to change behavior, you know, and then you get used to that. You know, we are over than 6 months, and people are getting new routine on their work and life balance. Would you see changing back to a new business as usual, which is not the one that we currently are in, easy, or it's more organization, government, you mentioned government as well, should find policy and solution for a different way of living?
I think that there's going to be quite a lot of variation in how that happens. You will probably be reading the same sorts of things I am, where some people are finding that working from home is fantastic and it's actually worked very well for them, and they're finding that their productivity has actually increased. They're happy about the fact that they're not traveling to work, and they still think that they're functioning at a high level and they've got enough social interaction. Whereas there are other people who are really missing that interaction in the workplace and can't wait to get back to the office for a whole range of reasons. And it could be that it's difficult for them to work at home, or they really do need that social interaction to help them function in a way which some people don't. Yeah. Organizations, though, I can see many of them probably thinking about what makes the best sense for their company or institution in terms of delivering the outcomes that they want from their workers, but also whether there are some cost savings potentially for maybe having less office space, but also whether they are finding that really some of these things which have been forced on us, like multiple Zoom meetings, have shown us that, in fact, for some of the time, they are actually quite efficient. So some companies and some institutions will be thinking, well, I'm definitely not going to have as many face-to-face meetings. We can function well without that. You might still want to have, though, social interactions at specific times, but less. So I can see a whole range of options being presented potentially in the future.
I like it, your concept of seeing different options, and that to me calls and speak to diversity. So the organizations is more aware of the need to diversify internal policy, way of working, you know, because some people love to work from home now. Some people need to go back to the office. And already those two elements add to a diverse approach to work. And maybe it's a good way for implementing diversity and inclusion within the organization more than before.
For sure. I also think that we have to accept that there are some jobs which can't be done from home. There are definitely jobs that you have to attend. You have to be in a certain place to perform the task. And those people, nothing may change for them at all, except that transport to and from work might be different. And because of COVID, for a long time, you're still going to have restrictions on the way you interact. So, you know, how long will we all be wearing masks? How long should we be very careful about our hand hygiene, etc.? So I can see that even when you do go to work, it won't be the same normal at all. It'll be a new sort of normal. But governments are definitely investing to try and get our business back into a situation where it's generating decreasing unemployment for starters, and then to get the economy growing again, which is my argument is that's fine, except it's not looking at that as a deep driver in that scenario.
Yeah. So we spoke about health. Let's go on the second scenario, global health awakening.
Yeah, this is much more of a sort of transformation scenario. And this is where you have large AI companies, science and startups with public health expertise coming to the rescue in some form. And you actually do enter truly the digital fourth age or fourth wave. So for healthcare, you'd have the things like genomics and artificial intelligence, even a 5P health model, which talks about prevention, precision, participation, partnership, and personalization. That would actually become the norm. So we'd actually get to the stage where we have real-time detection and health monitoring using big data, and that would cascade through the system, and that would be very important for the ongoing capacity to deal with things like COVID-19. We would also see working from home still booming with new relationships between the employer and employee. But broader things in this scenario were covered, like the universal basic income being supported in terms of being a strength of society. And it's actually, how do we treat the weakest and not to glorify the strongest in society? In this scenario also, young people are no longer just the future, but the present. So they are playing a central role. And this is the disruption that really creates that fourth industrial revolution. Also in this scenario, evidence-based science and technology inform public policy, not the whims of particular leaders, which we have seen since the start of this year in a number of countries where some leaders have disregarded some of the best scientific advice and spread almost misinformation. So this scenario wouldn't, this we're saying that that's not going to be the long term. In the longer term, science will actually prevail. And the insights actually from fighting COVID-19 would be applied to climate change, the big challenges. So taking notice of the science, which many countries have to battle COVID-19, would become the norm, so that the countries will be listening more to their scientists about the need to do something around climate change. So there could be a shift in this scenario, to plant-based diets, and it's actually business transformed. So it's not back to usual. It's more a social mutation. So it's a much more fundamental transformation. But in this scenario, the deep drivers of the growth issue associated with disease emergence are actually examined, and our obsession with economic growth is challenged. So what's also recognised is that the common drivers of these emerging infectious diseases are the same as global environmental change and climate change, and so they're recognised and acknowledged. So instead of seeing them all as separate little boxes, we start to see that there are some changes which are cross-cutting. And so the fact that we are now, as humans, you know, overwhelming the great forces of nature in a way, we have entered the Anthropocene. And people, instead of just seeing that as a topic which might be talked about and published in journals and even in the paper, people start to feel that more fundamentally. So there are concepts of actually starting to talk about a sustainable, steady state economics, which at the moment we're not hearing anything about. But in this scenario, this starts to get talked about in a mainstream sort of discourse. So there may still be heated debates about whether this can be a global approach or not, but at least the conversation is starting. The tragedy of the commons actually still sits front and centre, but in this scenario, taboo topics can actually be addressed, such as what's the need for a decreased global human population over time? Who is actually willing to truly decrease consumption? Hard question. Who wins if capitalism fails? This is sort of a zero-sum game thinking. But at least those issues start to be discussed. And the sense of urgency around those deeper drivers is starting to grow. And because the young are playing a central role here, they are actually taking leadership roles in politics, government, and organisations, including those sorts of things like Startups for Good. So here at least the door is open to start those serious conversations about the deep drivers and how to address them. So this transformation scenario, which has got a lot more fundamental shifts, starts to open that door so the deep drivers get addressed.
Yep. Yeah, this is very fascinating. I like a lot for a few reasons, but especially because the young, you know, which will be the future generation governing society, are taken into consideration rather than just, you know, let them to passively live their life, but they're actively taking responsibility and make decisions. So that was really interesting.
I just think that the issue around the young taking leadership is it's already happening. It's starting, but I can see and feel a sense of frustration with many younger people, and rightfully so, that my generation has really made things very difficult for the future. And why should the sorts of advice that somebody like me might provide be taken note of? It's the younger generation that's going to be dealing with the consequences of my generation's overconsumption and willing disregard for what's happened on the planet. So I can understand fully why they not only want to take control, but they need to take that level of control because it is their future, as you say.
Yeah, and what comes next from this is climate change. It's not something that we need to put it aside because we have COVID now. It's something that we need to deal at the same time because climate change is even bigger to some extent to the situation we are living now. And I remember this fantastic vignette at the beginning when COVID was something that everyone knew about, that there was a society here. There was a massive wave called COVID-19, and behind there was a bigger wave called climate change. So now we deal with that, and then we need to deal with climate change.
Yeah, actually I saw another cartoon very similar to that where there was a COVID-19 was like a shark eating us. But behind COVID-19, there was even a bigger shark, which was climate change swallowing the whole lot. And, you know, also the issues around biodiversity loss. There's a whole range of big issues associated with climate change and what we're doing to the planet. And there have been people commenting on this for many years. These are not new concepts. I think what's happening now, though, is because of the pause with COVID-19 and understanding that when governments really want to spend money to address an issue, they can. Previously, there was a lot of discussion about, well, we can't afford to do this. We'll move this bit slowly. We'll do a little bit of that. We'll try and get, you know, net zero emissions by 2050. But, you know, that's very expensive. Well, you know, Stern's report showed that you're actually better off to spend money early. It would make more sense. But the economic argument about not doing things has sort of faded a bit now that you can see how governments have been able to mobilise resources to address the COVID-19 sort of threat.
Yeah, if there is a need, the government is moving money to fulfil that need.
And the private sector, it's very clear that when you get this sort of emergency situation, the private sector is not in a position to do it. This is actually something that government needs to take a lead on. And with issues like climate change, you know, we've got the COP26 coming up next week, and there'll be a lot of discussion. But again, it takes the commitment of governments to actually do things. There'll be lots of good discussion, I'm sure, but we need action. And that's where you can understand that the younger generation are screaming for things to actually happen and stop talking.
Yeah, otherwise we want, we get into the third scenario, otherwise.
Sure. Well, the third scenario is what we call the Great Despair. And this is equivalent to the sort of collapse scenario. So it's not an apocalypse, not a depression. There's actually no magic. It's just a slow and marked decline of health and wealth. And wars appear everywhere. So the WHO, World Health Organization, and other organizations are actually trying their best to encourage countries to contain the virus, but the virus just repeatedly slips in and infects. In the article, he said it infects the bodies, minds, and actually the hearts of everyone. So it's like going back to the Middle European ages. So our efforts to actually address the virus fail. So in this scenario, it means there's no real effective vaccine or treatment. And so the vulnerable tend to get forgotten. There is an intergenerational memory of the sorts of past pandemics, but it's a pretty grisly sort of scenario. In this one, when you're looking at the economic growth issues, I have supposed that in this scenario, economic growth is actually supported in some elite pockets, but there's actually no global strategy for economic growth because it's now fragmented side of a global society with many suffering from the effects of COVID-19. But the paradox in this scenario is that over time, more and more people are asking, how did it actually come to this? And the answers slowly emerge. It's almost like the longer people are feeling the pain with COVID-19, the more likely they are to actually truly start to ask questions which will surface some of these deep drivers, because we won't be flicking back to anything like normal, and people will be asking, well, why are we in this situation? And so it may be that the so-called North and fast-growing South, which actually all contributed to this sort of milieu that has encouraged the emergence of the virus, we recognise that it's the sort of lack of care for each other that's helped to propagate the virus. So at a much deeper level, the driver is and was, in a way, a lack of respect and love for each other, but also for the planet. So we slowly come to the realisation that without a fundamental shift in how we interact with each other and the planet, the future will remain dim. So even though this is a darker scenario, in some ways it forces people to look more inwardly at what's causing and driving these issues. So economic growth is definitely no longer seen as apparent panacea. But in this scenario, it's still possible that there'll be a path out that's overgrown with competing interests and the continuing conspiracy type theories. So this is probably not a scenario that we want. It's probably one we'd like to avoid, but the seeds exist for it to emerge in many parts of the world now, I would argue. So there's actually a deeper understanding that actually emerges from these difficulties that are experienced directly in this scenario. So really what I'm saying is that things get worse before they even have a chance of getting better. But at least the deep drivers are likely to be addressed at some point, although it could be too late.
And this is why you mentioned correctly before that we need to act now before things get too bigger, then we won't be able to handle that anymore.
Well, the planet will go on, of course, but whether it's the sort of planet and lifestyle which most of us living on the planet would want is the question. And I think even when we finished the article in the blog earlier this year, we did finish with the fact that this is really, although it's a health crisis, yeah, you know, it's so much more. It's actually much more about leadership and governance and sort of what sort of world you want to live in. So it is a test of creation for a planetary civilization, forcing us to work together to actually solve the sorts of problems. And we said in that article that if we don't get this right, well, don't be surprised if there's another COVID or coronavirus around the corner, because we're not actually fundamentally getting to the bottom of the issues which are driving these, not only the emergence of viruses, but the fact that we are now living in the Anthropocene, where we are damaging the planet to such an extent, which is fundamentally damaging the systems which support life for us all to have a prosperous future.
Yeah, no, and what resonates mostly with me now is the underlying reasons behind those three scenarios, which is not just looking at what we have in front of us now currently, but it's more we need to, that's why we call it deep drivers. We need to understand the deep drivers to act on them to prevent future, you know, challenges to happen.
For sure. Actually, the issue around the deep drivers and the reason or how I initially came to even this way of thinking, although I could have come at it from so many different angles, was by doing a causal lab analysis on a topic with Sahail, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, 15 years ago, and realizing that the actual deep myth and metaphor that was driving the issue I was looking at was this whole thing around, you know, growth is king. That's the myth. And how do we shift to a position where actually the metaphor becomes something which is much more like to be, you know, sustainability rules or something which has a different ring to it, but it's we can still align to it and be strongly supportive of, but change our story. And, you know, with Sahail and his narrative foresight, so what's the narrative we can change from what we currently are experiencing, which will shift us to something which will help us perform and live a better life on the planet? So if we could get to that place, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. So how do we get to that place? Is us as individual? Is you know, the government is, I mean, we discussed that in this situation, the government has a really major role in changing and preventing. But yeah, how can we act on this?
Well, this is the reason that in the end, I chose to look at this issue through the economic lens, is because economic growth is fundamentally such a big player in how the planet, at least in the, you know, developed and developing world, is ruled very strongly by this economic way of thinking. And yet we don't have a lot of discussion, even though it's been raised for quite a long time, around different concepts of what sustainability means. The issues around degrowth, or actually steady state economics, you know, doesn't get talked about, because that's going to require us to fundamentally change the way we live on the planet in terms of what we consume and how we behave. And that's a very big ask. But we are asking some of that to happen in terms of climate change. So why aren't we taking them all into the same package at the same time and thinking about, well, what is it that's going to make sense? We know that economic growth is not, you know, infinite economic growth is not sustainable. We live on a finite planet. We are already chewing into the natural resources in this planet, on this planet, and we're suffering as a consequence. So if we keep just following the mantra of continued economic growth, we probably deserve what's going to come. We need to have a way of refreshing and resetting what it means to live on the planet. Now, it won't happen just with a bunch of individuals thinking around this. There are obviously a number of very smart people on the planet in academic institutions and think tanks who are already working on this. And even at COP26 next week, I notice a couple of speakers who will be carrying these sorts of issues. So it's not like it's not on the agenda. It's how do we shift a bigger proportion of the global population and private enterprise to understand how they can function in the future. And I don't see a really clear pathway at the moment, because I don't think there's been enough discussion and dialogue outside the people who already think this is the way for it to happen. So we're going to have to engage at a much broader level with a much wider audience and work out what the pathways, potential pathways are. I don't have a simple answer. How can we act on these? I do think, though, that the COVID-19 has given us that pause to reconsider and reframe how we might need to respond to these global challenges. So that's the gift that COVID-19 has given us. What can we do to leverage that and take the best advantage of it? And that's why the scenarios which we produced earlier this year, I thought it was worthwhile just putting that growth perspective over them to see what potential futures might exist with respect to that concept of how economic growth could be transformed.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Peter. This conversation has been so insightful, and hopefully also for many other listeners would get the good point and look forward to implement those and give young generation the leadership they deserved.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of smart young people out there, and I'm really hoping that they can take this challenge on and go forward. I've got a couple of daughters, and I can tell you I'm hoping that for their sake that happens.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Peter.
Okay.
The Briefing Today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams.